Hey there, welcome back to Card Overflow. So today I have somebody who I've looked to as an inspiration and an educational mentor of sorts. Kurt, you might not have known this, but Kurt Elster, CEO and co-founder of EtherCycle. How are you doing today?
I'm good. No, you mispronounced my name. It's pronounced Kurt Elster, a.k.a.
Tech Nasty.
There you go.
All right, I saw that. That's your Twitter handle. What's the story behind Tech Nasty? Because it's relatively new, right?
Ezra Firestone from, who does like Smart Marketer and Zipify Pages and all that stuff, I've known him for a while. He was a recurring guest on my show, and he said, "Hey, I want to sponsor your podcast." And he recorded a freestyle rap in which he refers to me as Tech Nasty and sent it to me. I was like, "Oh my gosh!" I said, "Can I use this?" He's like, "Please do." And then I cut. Like, I played it at the end of a show, but then I cut just the him yelling Tech Nasty.
Tech Nasty.
And now it was funny, so I kept using it. And then my wife has a Disney World podcast, and on that, I just show up and I'm the audience surrogate. I just play a dumb guy, but I also just, like, abuse my soundboard.
Nice.
And so the joke is I'd say, my name is Tech Nasty. And she'd say, "Nobody calls you that." And we did it so many times that in her reviews for her show, people started writing, like, "I'm only listening for Tech Nasty. Everybody calls him that." And then after that, I was like, "All right, I'll just keep doing it."
Yeah, we got to drop that to the LA Leakers, the freestyle show that I love to watch. But I actually do recognize Ezra's voice now that you mentioned that.
Yeah, once you know it's him, it's like, "Oh, yeah, that is Ezra.
Tech Nasty."
Yeah, you can hear it.
So Tech Nasty, aka Kurt, you're the man, and you constantly put out a lot of content in many forms and kind of like don't really hold a lot back in terms of like the strategies or the things that you're working on, the your analysis in the teardowns. And what I'd love to learn kind of like is your frameworks, your strategies of when you're taking on a client, what you're looking for in terms of, you know, they have their now, their current state, and then their goal. You know, let's say it's six figures. How do you become a seven-figure store? But in terms of scale and kind of like understanding the fundamentals and levers for growth, can you explain what your process is at EtherCycle?
Yeah, absolutely. So, ideally you want a validated business. So like right now in e-commerce, it's kind of interesting. There's so much money just lurching into the space, seeking alpha, seeking a return on investment. And so you see a lot of acquisitions and you see a lot of private equity firms showing up and buying stuff. And the reason is pretty simple, is starting a business is the risky, scary thing. Buying a business that has proven itself to be viable and plausible and profitable and then scaling it, well, that's actually the easier part. Right? Like the ones that make it after several years, the chances are they're going to stick around. So scaling is the easier part. So you want to define those businesses where, okay, they have already found their product market fit. And once you have that, all right, then it becomes, and you're able to sell consistently, then it becomes a question of, all right, which levers do we pull? What is the weak link in the chain here? And the magic of e-commerce is it's a pretty simple formula. It's traffic times conversion rate times average order value. That's your revenue. That's it. We dumb it down as far as it'll go. It's really three inputs that are going to determine the revenue this business drives. Now that there's like new versus returning customers, and this also ignores profit. You know, I could sell $5 gift cards for $1 all day, and it will probably go very well revenue-wise, but not so good on profit. So like, okay, there's a lot of stuff I'm glossing over in this example. But that's what we're looking for is, all right, which are we have an established business, okay, and we know what these levers are, we know what the funnel is. Where is the weak link? What's the thing that either we go, all right, this is the bottleneck, can we fix that? Or all inputs being the same, okay, which is the lever to pull? And often the answer is average order value, because traffic's the tough thing to get, right? iOS 14 has blown up our lookalike audiences and really made some trouble for us, but if I still could keep that consistent traffic and I still have the same conversion rate and I can increase average order value, revenue goes up. Well, suddenly now the business is significant, has way more value, has more cash flow, is more saleable, has more an easier time spending on, you know, new PPC ads, that kind of thing. So, I mean, at a high level, that's the view.
So in improving average order value, are you seeing that that's more of like a psychological play in terms of the positioning and getting them to the higher, the more expensive, higher AOV products with the copywriting, say, or the product positioning? Or is it maybe something more design oriented of how the product description page is laid out and how the buttons kind of like grab your attention and reducing obstacles to the checkout?
I love design, but I think of myself as a recovered web designer, because what I have found is good design doesn't hurt, bad design doesn't help. But it really is nowhere near as important as, especially in an e-commerce store anyway, the merchandising, and in almost any B2C or even B2B site, anything, it's going to be less important than positioning, messaging, copywriting. And of the conversion rate optimization exercises we've done, consistently copywriting is the one that really moves the needle. Because that's like the web is 90% text to begin with, right? So I think that's where that, well, and, you know, copywriting's hard. And so it's the thing people are least likely to do. It's the one that feels like homework versus like, oh, I need to look at designs and decide subjectively which one I like and pick that. Like that's just a much more, that's an easier thing to do. It's seductive.
Yeah, so it's almost like, and I've seen, you know, in different groups, people might tinker with different themes or wonder if they need to get a custom theme. In some ways, like the basic out-of-the-box theme can work. It's designed by a professional, but it might be the copywriting or how you're actually tugging at the emotions to drive that conversion. Any particular frameworks that you use, let's say like, you know, ADA, Tentrist, Interest, Desire, Action, or Pass, Problem, Agitation, Solution, anything that you
I
think
like
about?
100% I'm following Pass. Pain or problem, agitate the pain, like define the pain or problem, agitate the pain, and then present, well, and then I like, you know, present a vision of the world without that, and then present your solution, and then risk reversal. The one that I really did not understand persuasive copywriting for sales, no matter how hard I tried. I read the Leo Burnett books, I read all kinds of copywriting books, and I was reading it, I wasn't getting it. And then I read The Brain Audit by Sean D'Souza. It took me like 30 minutes in a Starbucks. This thing is a quick read. And I was like, well, here it is. Like, this is the straightforward framework. It is presented in a way that makes sense. And I could do this. And suddenly, oh, it clicked. I went, okay, now I understand copywriting. And really, like, I think his is a 7-step formula, but it's very much like an extended version of PASS, P-A-S. And then you could take that idea, like those frameworks, and you could apply that to a product description. You take your best-selling product, rewrite the product description as a sales letter, watch your sales take off. You won't believe it. And then once you figure out, okay, and you can even split test product descriptions if you have the traffic. Like if you're doing 5 million a year and you're trying to get to 10 million, this might be the way to do it. And then like once I know, all right, this is the pain, this is the problem, this is the thing that really seems to resonate with people. And maybe I figure that through reading reviews or surveys or talking to my customers on the phone. I know that's like very terrifying for millennials. Then I could figure out like a headline that will, or a tagline. You know, I could really, if I could dumb down that thing to 3 to 5 words where you know immediately this is meant for me, well, that's when things really take off. But that's a lot harder to do than it sounds.
Yeah. It reminds me, I forget the name of the book. It might have been David Ogilvy, but basically like that his trick is 2 words. And so there, everybody has like human emotions and their needs. And it's kind of like Maslow's hierarchy. You get your food, your shelter, your clothing, and then it moves up to like social things, and it moves up to like kind of status. And so there are things that we want, but then when you're inserting your product in there, the 2 words that he suggests to use are so that. And so for example, people want, you know, glasses so that for their eyes and to look fashionable so that they can, you know, whatever it is, attract the right type of people that they're looking for or look a certain way. But it's that bridge of like quotation marks so that they can do this. And I think that might be another way of explaining what you just explained of like how to get a customer from where they're at to the best version of themselves that they hope to achieve.
Yeah, it's like we think of sales funnels, but I think the thing people miss in there is there are steps within steps. So it's, you know, you may have dumbed it down to like they viewed product. That's one step. There's so much. That's like the make or break moment. That's where the purchase decision is happening, is on that product page. And that's where, you know, like a sales letter-esque product description really makes it. And that's where you have to go through those exercises and those processes and those frameworks and figure it out. And one may work better than another. That's where, like, you know, in Google Optimize, you can split test product descriptions, like entirely swap out the product description or sections of it and really dial into, like, this is what about this works. And then once you know what works, okay, now we can start applying that to other products, other ads, other emails, and start working through it. But, like, once you're already in this position where you're doing, like, say you're doing a million in your revenue, that's awesome, because a million in your business is some copywriting and a few levers away from becoming a $10 million a year business.
Interesting. So maybe we can like use some examples of brands that you've worked with, like Tactical Baby Gear, for example. And I don't know if this was like in the specifics of what you did there, but when you're saying, okay, maybe it'll be copywriting that will make the difference, that will actually persuade somebody on the product description page to add to cart, to check out. You come up with a hypothesis. Is that what you're saying? You say like, let's try a different angle. You set up Google Optimize, you have an A/B test to evenly split the traffic. And then from there, you're looking at the results. So I guess my question is, at a high level, you have your hypothesis of the feeling that you're trying to evoke or how you're trying to position the product. And then you get into testing the different taglines or the descriptions or the text itself.
Yes. And so I think, all right, if you're looking for a decision-making framework, the one that is simple, it is straightforward, that I've been following is OODA Loop. And It's Air Force Colonel John Boyd who wanted, like, okay, we need a way to teach people combat decision-making. And so he came up with this idea called the OODA Loop. And OODA is great. It's an easy thing to memorize. It stands for Observe, Orient, Decide, Act. So in Observe, we're going to look at our Shopify analytics, our customer surveys, our heat, whatever our available heuristic data is. And all right, so we've got that. And we start to try and figure out where the problem is. And then orient. All right, here's where we're going to make our hypothesis. Like, okay, here's the thing we're going to test. And we need a way to be able to test it to know if it works. Otherwise, you're just throwing stuff against the wall. And maybe you got lucky and it's coincidental that it worked. You don't know. That's why I love, love, love split testing. But downside to split testing requires a fair amount of traffic, so I understand it's not practical for everything. All right, with that out of the way, then we've got decide and act. And decide is, okay, you know, we reach statistical significance, we implement it, and you know, we permanently implement it, and then which covers act. But more importantly, last step in act is go back to step one. So you just keep repeating that same cycle indefinitely, where you go like, okay, where is the weak link in this chain? All right. We've identified it. What are we going to do about it? Test, test, test until we fix it. Start again.
Yeah. I remember actually that was at my previous company, we did have some ex-military and that was like that came up as a framework and I really like it too.
I like OODA Loop because it feels, once you hear it, you're like, it's very straightforward. It makes sense. Observe, yeah. Orient, decide, act.
And, you know, like the beauty of a checklist is it doesn't leave any steps. And that, you know, Atul Gawande, who's like a Harvard medical school doctor, or professor, I don't know if you know him, but basically like that's where the biggest mistakes happen in a surgery room in the military. And if you can follow a simple checklist, then it just removes this burden this mental burden that makes things a lot easier.
Yeah, the issue really is your short-term memory is just not that long. Like a phone number is 7 digits because that's about as much as you can hold in your head. And yeah. So having a checklist, even for simple repetitive tasks, really, it makes it much easier because you're not thinking about like, wait, where was I? What did I do? Oh, I could just reference this. I live and die by lists. I love them dearly.
Yeah.
I'm working on a thing now. I got a list in front of me. Actually, now I got one, two. I have three lists in front of me at the moment.
So you got to number your lists, get meta.
Yeah. There's a master list to determine which of the lists we're currently referencing. No, don't go that crazy. But you know, you figure out what tools, what makes sense for you. Like I like a pen and paper. You know, it's simple, it's practical, it just works. You just like a legal pad, I think, and I start fresh with a fresh legal pad every day. That is my favorite way to work. Low tech.
Yeah, low tech, but it also low risk. So, you know, like you don't necessarily feel like you have to be precious with your space or what you're writing down. Just scribble it down, get it out. So, do you think maybe we can do an OODA loop now?
Let's attempt it.
Yeah, all right. So, let's observe what's going on. And I'd love to hear maybe how you're acting on it from your perspective as CEO of EtherCycle. Things are kind of in flux, so to speak, with paid ads not necessarily delivering the same return on investment or return on ad spend that they were historically. Access to data not there as it has been historically. Supply chain, so that's a whole other issue. And then we have Black Friday, Cyber Monday coming up not too far away. But it seems like the marketing game plan, the blueprint of what has worked is changing and is changing in real time. How are you observing? How are you kind of like making the decisions and testing different things in this new environment?
So I think currently I'm really leaning on observe and orient, in which I am really just asking a lot of other people, like, okay, how are you? Like, what has been the impact on you, and how are you dealing with it? And what's interesting about it is, like, you're talking to other people, no one is, I don't think anyone is like truly in, has it figured out. I think everyone is still trying to decide on this is the right approach. I think there's a lot of, because it's evolving, I think there's a lot of testing and tuning going on. And I think you have to lean on what's worked in, I think at this point you need like a make money today strategy, make money tomorrow strategy, where lean on what you know is going to work, but then also be actively committing time to testing other things, new things. So, all right, so that was broad. That was very general. Let's try and narrow it down. Your
So
turn
if we
for
say,
talking.
okay, paid ads, like CPMs, cost of acquisition, ad spend itself, not quite as targeted. That might not be like the path to go down. What I'm seeing is, and maybe of course I have a biased perspective running a quiz builder, but a focus more on lead gen, so building a list, shifting people even from email to SMS, that SMS as a channel is having outsized gains for the brands. Maybe also because it's an early enough where people aren't necessarily competing with brands in somebody's text inbox. And then kind of like this notion of an owned relationship as opposed to relying on paid acquisition, paid ads, kind of like buying awareness.
Okay. All right. So if we're going to apply this to a very direct, immediate Facebook plan, we're going to observe our platform stats. So that's like our leading indicators, cost per click, click-through rate, add to cart rate, and then our lag indicators, if we have them, which is going to be MERS or ROAS, right? And that, so that, those are our inputs. That's our observation. Orient is, are we hitting our goal? Is this working? Is there anything, are there red flags here? Do I need to change anything? Decide then is going to be, come up with a hypothesis, or decide really, does anything need to change at this time? Do we need to turn ads off, adjust spend, launch new creatives? And then finally, act is going to be implement and then restart. Go back to observe, do it again. Because really, like with Facebook ads, you're in this constant iterative cycle. Is that more what you're looking for?
I mean, definitely. And I, you know, there is no right answer, like you stated at the outset. This is like a situation that's unfolding. I think in some ways, Facebook itself is probably being reactive to the data that they're now working with.
Reactive. Yeah, and I think really just the thing to watch for is that you're not reactionary. Like you don't just want to have like an event occurs, you panic, knee-jerk reaction, and you're like, all right, we're just going to delete our Facebook accounts and go all in on TikTok. It's just like, okay, that's what you're trying to avoid by having these frameworks. They really like the advantage of the framework is to slow down your decision-making so that you avoid those very reactionary processes.
Yeah, totally. Now, like Black Friday, Cyber Monday, like we mentioned, not too far away. Have you also gotten into how this might change in 2022, or is the 2022 plan kind of like that'll come when it comes? It's just not really on the drawing board at the moment.
We don't know. And the other thing, like that, we have logistics issues, so supply chain shortages. We don't know if we'll have another Shipageddon event this year, or how bad it'll be, and how long it'll take
like
to come out of that.
Suez Canal, some Suez Canal being blocked for a week.
Well, that's where with the supply chain shortages, we've got that Suez Canal event happening at a much bigger scale. You know, to the point where now, like, the White House is releasing statements about it. Shipageddon, you know, last year we just had stuff not making it through that last mile delivery, and like these terrifying photos of warehouses packed to the top with boxes. You know, with that in recent memory, they're trying to staff up to fix it, but who knows, especially with labor shortages occurring. And then, so like, I think those two are wild cards. You know, I don't know how long it takes to recover from that, or what the knock-on effect.
Which is a nice segue into what I wanted to talk to you next about, which is basically customer experience. And I see that, like, ultimately, like, that seems at the core a lot of like the work that you do. How can you create the best customer experience on site, which would reduce any obstacles to conversion, and therefore make it a far better shopping experience, both the first time and for returning customers. How does one stand out in a customer experience in, say, 2021 or beyond? Like, what are the foundations of a good customer experience in your mind when you're doing an audit, for example, for a new potential client, where you're going through and doing your own shopping experience, where a good brand or a brand with a good customer experience can differentiate from the rest of the pack?
Sure. So I think number one, you want to look for the friction points. And the reason that's harder to do than it sounds is, if you are a merchant, you are a web professional. You spend more time on your website than anybody else, and you probably do it on desktop. So you are now using your own website in a way that nobody else does, convinced you know it better than everybody else. And the reality is, your customers see your website for like 2 minutes total, maybe, on a mobile device from their pocket while they're probably also doing something else like watch TV. Like, they're just not looking at it in the same way as you, the merchant owner operator. And so I think that's the big mistake and the trouble that people get themselves into, where, okay, now you have to hire an expensive consultant to look at the site and go, hey, here's a list of all the things that you have learned to just ignore that's wrong with the site. I mean, that's really what happens, is they develop change blindness very quick. And so, like, I'll go through it and say, okay, like, here's all the friction points and annoyances and weird things that I identified. Let's fix that first. And then, all right, if we fixed all that and we've really, like, we've polished off the rough edges here, now let's look at our KPIs, decide which one is our opportunity, which one is our weak point, and then let's develop split tests around improving those. Like, once we've fixed what definitely feel like issues, now let's start testing improvements or optimizations.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I've seen this as well from like a shopper perspective, and then also kind of like QAing our own app is on a device. Usually we just do like a Chrome inspector. I don't know if you have a better third party tool. I know that there are like sites that you can do it. But yeah, the one thing that we're competing with sometimes are pop-ups on top of like,
yeah, the sticky elements.
And yeah.
And on desktop, it's less annoying. On mobile, you have a very limited viewport. So like, oh, I've got it's important. It should be sticky. It's got to be, I got all these sticky elements. Well, pretty soon, like, how much space is left for content? And then, yeah, you end up with that scenario where it's like, there's a pop-up that opened and the close button is stuck behind like your loyalty points widget, which is next to your review widget, your back in stock widget. And then another pop-up opens. And so now, like, very quickly, it is not uncommon that you could end up on an e-commerce store on your phone and just straight up the layer of garbage barnacles stuck to the sides of the screen entirely obscure the content. Well, yeah. Gee, I think I found the conversion problem here. I can't see the website.
Yeah. You get a really good tweet, I think, about that. It's basically like, all right, you don't want to go through a whole bunch of screen recordings and watch individual session after individual session. But in a tool like Hotjar or some screen recording, we use something called LogRocket, you can actually just see like repetitive clicks in the same div or in the same area, like rage
and
clicks.
What, sir, are those called? A rage click.
Yeah.
That's the fun. Yeah, because screen recordings, like, you sit and you just watch them. And, like, you better be, you know, eating lunch at the time because it's mind-numbing after you watch several. And it's really frustrating to see. You're like, what were you doing? What is happening here? Yeah, right? Because there's so much context missing. But if you jump to the rage clicks, that's where you identify the friction points and the problems. And you start to see, especially like, all right, if you see, you know, five people ran into a rage click issue in seemingly the same place. Okay, now you're onto something. Now you're onto a friction point where you're like, that's costing you money. Because when people rage click, they're less likely to buy and they're more likely to just close that tab and go elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you're referencing Hotjar specifically, but is there a button where it would self-select all rage clicks?
Yeah, in Hotjar, you could filter for it.
You can filter, okay. And I assume it might be like three clicks in less than a second or something along those lines.
I think it's five. I don't know, I'm making that up.
Okay.
Three doesn't feel like enough. I want five clicks. Maybe, yeah, you know, let me define my rage clicks. Maybe like sort them for me. Like, man, this guy clicked 30 times in 10 seconds, freaking out.
Yeah.
All right, yeah, that's the one I want. What happened there? But like that's it really, I think customer service is often an untapped of opportunity where we've got it. You know, oftentimes we'll go like, what's, you know, we've solved obvious issues on the site, you know, and then you've got your screen recordings with your rate clicking. Well, what are you looking for there? You're looking for people who are frustrated. Well, with customer service, that's often a good place to go. Like mine chat, mine customer support inquiries, talk to customer support reps and be like, what are the issues people keep having? Like, what's the stuff that's driving you crazy as a customer support rep? Because for every customer who's got that issue that they brought to you, there were 10 more that had the same issue and didn't say anything. So, all right, let's solve for those. And then the organization runs smoother, right? You're wasting less time on these problems that nobody wants to have. And then for the customers themselves, okay, I no longer have to deal with this nonsense.
Yeah, that's a great point. And a lot of that probably, like when you're talking about tickets or questions that people might not have, there might not be rage clicks per se, but there might be a lot of questions about like shipping, right? Or return policy, or maybe even sourcing if there's like some sustainability impact. But that, yeah, not everything comes through in a rage click, I guess. But I get a lot of the support tickets myself. And if I do get a few, I'll just create a ticket or a help doc, because you're totally right. That's important for scale. I kind of wanted to ask you a little bit of an off topic question, but again, sure. you have like so many, like you're just so immersed in this. NFTs and e-commerce. It's something that's really interesting to me because Shopify now supports NFTs as of July. I think they had a beta test with the Chicago Bulls. And then I actually just saw recently like Jimmy Butler, who's like, you know, superstar on the, what is he on now? The Heat, I guess. He's got his own coffee brand, but with some of the supply issues, he's now doing an NFT stuff. Other brands, other celebrities, people with followings, going to NFT. And it kind of makes sense because there are so many different applications of an NFT, a non-fungible token, which is, you know, could be as simple as a JPEG, but it is programmable. It's a store of value. And in some ways, I think going to be the future of, you know, transaction or commerce. I think a lot of people would say that, but what are you seeing in terms of NFT and commerce?
So certainly crypto is not going away. The blockchain is not going away. Selling Gen Z kids non-fungible tokens for URLs to JPEGs. How is this not just this month's tulips? How is it we're selling a URL to a photo of a Beanie Baby? Convince me. Change my mind.
All right. I will do my best, but I think there are a couple interesting ways. One is that it's access. So, you know, an NFT, you can have access to a Discord server, for example, where it might be, you know, some kind of like of a certain people of a certain ilk or hard to access. But if you're in there and there certainly might be a price tag to it, with that NFT, you automatically have access into that. You can sell it, you can trade it, and then you no longer have access because it's verified every time you try to enter that community. But that's one way. Another way might be kind of like ongoing discounts or access to VIP. So if you know you buy this NFT now, and then you have early access to 20% off on, you know, for into perpetuity or whatever that might be. And then the third that might be a stretch, but as this metaverse idea comes about, it's just a way for people to flex, you know, if there is, there's a Nike NFT and then, you know, these limited editions, and we've seen what StockX and GOAT have done and with a secondary market. But imagine if there are these, you know, literally one of a kind shoes that you'd put on your metaverse avatar, then that would be another way. And again, that kind of becomes a store of value, an investment, and an asset class in itself.
So I think I certainly think Gen Z as digital natives, I think all of this is more natural and normal for them. And they're the next generation. So fundamentally, you know, it's probably not going away. Or if it is, it's because it evolved into something else. And I think the way for Luddites like myself to think about an NFT is it's an indestructible poker chip. It is representative of another form of value. And then, okay, now the real magic, I think, in what you said was in that the NFTs are a very practical way to create, to do limited edition digital goods, which was a thing not previously possible or practical. And so the blockchain really like enables that. And that, I think, is where it's going to go. Like urgency and scarcity. I mean, yeah. The basic psychological levers that are used in marketing today will be used 100 years from now, were used 100 years ago. That doesn't change. The fact that I keep overpaying like $300 for sneakers because they're hard to get and bizarre looking. I mean, here.
Yeah.
Look at this. Please describe these shoes for our audio listeners.
Those look like bubblegum pink SB1s.
Thank you. Yes, they're fuchsia SB Dunks, which I overpaid for and they're absurd. And the only reason is because they were like super limited and that scarcity is what drives it. Well, NFTs let you do the exact same thing with digital goods. And so that aspect of human psychology doesn't change, doesn't go away. And so like, it's not going to be for everybody. It isn't. But for the people who, you know, it does make sense to, it's a big market.
Yeah. Let's revisit this in a few years and see, because we're starting to see a few people do it. And yeah, it might not be for everybody and it might not be for every vertical, even for those, for example, that are sustainable minded, because there are environmental impacts to kind of like the minting process and whatever else. But I think we're just at the cusp of it. And I think it's really interesting.
I agree. So. It's certainly like I've owned crypto. I've invested in crypto for years now. And I was like, well, you know, maybe there's nothing here, but why not? You know, let's diversify a little bit. And then sure enough, it hasn't gone away. It has gotten bigger. And so NFTs, you know, I waffle between, you know, like, this is silly, this is this month's tulips, or, hey, it doesn't have to make sense to me for it to make sense to enough people that it's not going away.
Yeah.
Like, just straight up, you don't have to get it. Like, you don't have to like everything. It's just not for you. But that doesn't mean it'll cease to exist just because you don't like it.
Yeah, most definitely. Kurt, now wrapping up, I have one hard question, but I think you have the wealth of knowledge to answer it. And that's over, you know, your 1.5 million downloads or 400 episodes or, you know, all this, the years of work that you put in, the main takeaway that you're kind of like the answer to the riddle of how do I actually become a seven-figure store? How do I scale? What is that most important insight that you would have?
The stores we've worked with that have really excelled and hit seven and figures, there are some commonalities there. They're general, like, number one, all of the ones I could think of are constantly releasing or re-releasing products. It's either like, here, we've launched this product, it is sold out. We've launched this other product, it's sold out. And we just like round robin through that. Or, hey, we re-release this as a limited edition. Or like it's in a new, you know, like Adam's polishes. Like, hey, our quick detailer spray, now available in pumpkin spice. I'm not even kidding. They'll re-release product, car wash products in pumpkin spice in the fall. And of course, they do very well with this. So that again, we talked about human psychology. Well, one thing the human brain craves is novelty. And that's when you're like, when you're doing a lot of product launches, novelty is what saves you. Same with, I think, like, that's one aspect. Number two is community and content. The really successful brands produce a lot of content and a lot of new content. So again, it's that novelty. But like, I think content is a means to an end, because it often results in, we didn't just build an audience, we built a community around it. And that's very powerful. And then I think the final point is, you got to know your story, because you have to be able to tell your story so that your customers can retell your story. And that's how those brands get word of mouth. And then it also helps drive that community aspect and ultimately sales. So I think those are the three things you got to nail, is that address. Okay, so number one, we're going to call innovate, where it's like, let's keep doing product launches, whatever it takes, consistently. Number two, content and community. I don't think you could separate those. And then three, your story. And I think they're all important.
And I guess, yeah, novelty kind of fits into innovation in some sense, right?
Yeah, I think, yeah, innovate. Yeah, the advantage of innovation is that you're pulling on that novelty lever. Who doesn't like new shiny toys, is what's going on?
Yeah, not Tech Nasty, right?
Tech Nasty.
Kurt, thank you so much for sharing so much and kind of like playing along, because I asked these questions at a little bit random, but I really appreciate it and value your insight. So best place to find you online, I guess, EtherCycle.
EtherCycle.com is our agency if you want to hire us. Otherwise, Google me, Kurt Elster. Head to KurtElster.com. That's got everything you could want to know about me. Or, you know, I'm big on Twitter, Kurt Inc., I-N-C, K-U-R-T-I-N-C. Yeah.
Awesome. Kurt, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was a great episode. Yeah,
and that's the episode for today. Thanks so much for listening all the way to the end. We love you for it. If you found anything valuable at all or want to share your feedback, please leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can also just drop us a line, hello@cartoverflow.com. We'd love to hear your feedback or suggestions so we can cover it in a future episode. All right, see you next time.